Jan Vilcek's life has been a story of defying the odds. He was able to evade being sent to the concentration camps when he was growing up in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia, only to come of age under communist rule. After he fled his country as a young scientist, he would go on to become one of the world's most celebrated immunologists. Now, in a memoir called Love and Science, Mr. Vilcek describes the roles a combination of luck, perseverance, and the kindness of others played in his remarkable career in biomedical research. The book is published by Seven Stories Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jan Vilcek to our show today. Hello.
I'm delighted to be here.
Your parents were proud of their Jewish heritage, but you also say they had a complicated attitude toward their Jewishness long before and after the Second World War.
That is correct. It was actually not unusual in that part of the world for Jewish people not to wear their Jewishness on their sleeves or to be completely secular. And
so you celebrated Christmas, but did you celebrate the Jewish holidays as well?
We actually did not, no. But again, it was, I know it sounds strange, in New York City especially, but it was not unusual in that part of the world.
Well, I've spoken to a number of people who lived through that period where there were a lot of pressure on them to convert. On your family as well?
Yes. Well, I was a child, and I had no say, but I was growing up without any religious education. And then when I was six and just after the Second World War broke out, my mother decided that she will convert and she will have me baptized as well.
And then your father converted a few years later.
My father converted a little more reluctantly about 2 years later.
The Slovak government would pass the Jewish Codex that discriminated against Jews on the basis of race and ancestry, not religious practice. So did converting protect you and your family?
I believe that it helped my family to survive. You are right that the Jewish Codex did not distinguish between people who converted or didn't convert, but at the same time Slovakia was had a pro-Nazi government that was headed by a Catholic priest, and I think with some pressure from the Vatican, eventually after about two-thirds of the Jews were deported to concentration camp, the deportation stopped. And at that point, educated people and people who converted were in a better position.
What about opportunities for schooling?
After I finished my second grade, I could no longer continue in a regular school because Jews had to go to special designated schools for Jewish children. My parents, to protect me, placed me in a Catholic orphanage, which was a very unusual solution. And I spent 2 years in the Catholic orphanage going to school there.
Were you the only Jewish kid being hidden that way?
Actually, there was another Jewish kid, my close friend, with whom we are still friends today, who was there with me.
But were they teaching pro-Nazi ideology in the school?
If they were perhaps not teaching explicit pro-Nazi ideology, but we had Catholic classes in Catholic religion, and yes, we were expected to celebrate national holidays, including birthdays of the pro-Nazi leaders.
And that attracted you? You want to be like the other kids?
Well, yes. I recollect that I indeed started believing in Catholic religion. I was even serving as an altar boy. But of course, I cannot remember exactly what I thought and what I felt.
So you don't remember whether you understood that you were being hidden there?
I think I had some understanding of that, yes.
And then you, your mother and your father all survived to see the day of liberation when the Soviet Army marched in April 1945. How close do you think they were to getting caught?
Well, we had indeed many close calls. We were hiding, my mother and I were hiding for the last 7 months of the Second World War in a village. We lived more or less in the open, and there were German soldiers coming in and out, and I witnessed how another Jewish family in the same village was caught, and they did not survive. So we had a lot of good luck, and we were very fortunate to have found a couple, a family who protected us.
Did you have a scientific bent at the time?
Not really. I liked all the subjects at school, including the science subjects, but I think I had a slight preference for the humanities. When I was closer to finishing high school, I was toying with the idea to become a journalist. I liked creative writing. So probably had I been growing up in a normal society, I would have chosen some other field. But because in a communist system, journalism was really highly politicized, and I realized it wasn't appropriate. I eventually ended up doing medical school.
But weren't the sciences also highly politicized? For example, when we talk about medicine, genetics became a real problem with Stalinist thought.
That is correct. But still, most of medicine, including most basic sciences and certainly the clinical fields of medicine, could not be highly politicized. But you are absolutely right about genetics. There was this agronomist in the Soviet Union, Trofim Lysenko, and he came up with his own theories of inheritance and rejected classical genetics.
It was kind of like Linnaeus earlier, based on the idea that I guess Stalin had, that everyone could be improved. And so genes would suggest that we were born with traits that could not be improved.
That's absolutely correct.
Now, but you chose to get into research, not into clinical practice?
When I entered medical school, I really didn't know what I will end up doing. But when I was in the second year of medical school, and medical school in Europe takes 6 years because you enter it right after high school, and the first year...
It's not a postgraduate study.
That's right. So when I was in the second year of the six-year medical studies, I volunteered for a project in the Department of Microbiology and Immunology, and I almost instantly fell in love with the idea of doing scientific research.
Wasn't immunology a young field of study at that time?
Absolutely, yes, and still quite descriptive, and very, very little was known about the actual mechanisms whereby the immune system works.
And then there's a whole matter of virology. How does virology relate to the study of immunology?
There are connections. It is a separate discipline, but in order to resist virus infections, we need our immune system.
Well, we need it for bacterial infections
as well.
But is it a different process?
It's a similar process. There are some differences in the way we protect ourselves against viruses and against bacteria, but the processes are indeed quite similar.
My guest is Jan Vilcek, who has written a memoir called Love and Science. Are viruses more or less responsible for making humans sick compared to other microorganisms?
I think about 50% of all occurrences of infectious diseases are caused by viruses. I don't guarantee that this number is absolutely correct. So about half of all infections that we experience are caused by viruses.
Was it dangerous to work on viruses at the time?
So I happened to work when I was in Czechoslovakia on a virus called tick-borne encephalitis virus, which is transmitted by ticks, mm-hmm. and causes an inflammation of the brain, encephalitis. And indeed, it was not completely safe to work with that kind of virus. And
you could become infected?
You could get infected, and most people recover after infection, but many people do suffer some neurological damage.
Hey, you're right that 20% of all human cancers have a proven viral cause. I didn't know that.
Yes, and of course...
I thought it was just genes gone wild.
that is part of it, but viruses certainly contribute. To give you an example, papilloma viruses cause uterine cancer and other types of cancer as well. Hepatitis B and hepatitis C viruses, because they cause a long-lasting chronic inflammation, are a major cause of liver cancer.
Did you feel constrained doing this work in Czechoslovakia? Is that why you left?
That was part of the reason. There was a real lack of personal freedom. I was offered a fellowship in London, and the authorities declined to let me go. Also,
did you see signs of what was to come 4 years later with Prague Spring?
Probably not. We left in 1964, and I think there was a little bit of a relaxation of the very orthodox communist system, but Prague Spring was, as far as I can tell, not yet in the air.
So you say you were denied the opportunity to leave. So how did you get out? And was it it must have been a difficult decision, because you had to leave your family behind.
Absolutely. So by then, I was married, and to our surprise, my wife and I were given a permission to visit friends in Vienna for 48 hours. We didn't actually have a passport. We just had a border pass. But we knew, nevertheless, that once we get out, we will not come back.
Was there a chance that you could be sent back? I would assume that you would have been punished for trying to escape.
Absolutely. Actually, we were sentenced in absentia to prison terms and loss of our property. Fortunately, we didn't own much, so that didn't hurt too much.
But what about the families you left behind? Were they punished?
They were not punished, partly because my parents were already either retired or very close to retirement. My wife's father was retired. And also, as I said, the regime was, while not still becoming a democratic system, but was slightly less rigid than before.
Did you have a final destination or a job lined up?
We always knew that we wanted to come to the United States, but we didn't know how long it would take before we got our visas. And we had a kind of understanding with a colleague in Belgium that I would be given a temporary job in Belgium. But we couldn't get there because we didn't have a passport, and actually were in a very rude and unceremonious way thrown out of the Belgian consulate in Vienna at the time.
How did you wind up in New York?
Partly because my wife's brother lived in New York at the time, and partly because I was fortunate to receive a job offer from New York University, where I'm still to this day.
And my guest is Jan Vilcek, professor of microbiology at NYU's Langone Medical Center. His memoir, Love and Science, is published by Seven Stories Press. You came to New York and had your first martini ever.
That is correct, and did not immediately like it.
Who were your colleagues when you first came to the Department of Microbiology at NYU? Were they more sophisticated than you because you were coming from Czechoslovakia?
Well, perhaps they were more sophisticated.
I'm sure you caught up right away.
not right away. It took a little time. I had to learn, but at the same time, I think I had a pretty good education in microbiology and virology. I was able to read still in Czechoslovakia, so I was not completely naive.
Much of the research involved interferon, a drug that has remained controversial. What were you hoping to find out about it?
So you said interferon is a drug that is correct, but before it
became... Well, it has such terrible side effects.
Before it became a drug, it's actually produced by our bodies, and it has an important function in our bodies because it protects us from virus infections and protects us from other infections as well. You are right. There was hope that interferon would become useful as a drug.
To fight cancer, mostly.
Partly to fight cancer, but also virus infections. And actually, it was developed into a drug. It never became very successful in cancer. It is still used in some situations, but not very widely. It is also used in some diseases where viruses are not the immediate cause of the disease, for example, in multiple sclerosis.
Well, I wonder why, if something is created naturally by the body, when it's given to us in drug form, the body doesn't respond well to it. It's just a matter of dosage?
It's the matter of dosage, and it's the matter of the site where the drug acts. In our bodies, interferon is produced locally in relatively small quantities, and under those circumstances, it is useful. When it is given systemically by injection and it distributes into the whole body, it can cause side effects.
You went on to spend 25 years of your professional life studying something called TNF, or tumor necrosis factor. What is that?
Tumor necrosis factor is a member of the same family of compounds as interferon. They are proteins. So both interferon and TNF are proteins made in our body. And they can serve a useful function. But in the case of TNF, when it is overproduced in the body, it can lead to an inflammatory reaction, and actually it triggers many autoimmune chronic inflammatory diseases, including rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, ankylosing spondylitis, psoriasis, and the list goes on.
And when did you discover that it could do that? It did that.
Well, I don't think I discovered
obviously, you were working with a team.
There were many groups of people working in the world that eventually made it clear that TNF has these effects. When it became clear that TNF can be harmful, some laboratories, including my laboratory, became interested in trying to develop antagonists to TNF. And this is when we decided to make what is called a monoclonal antibody, an artificial antibody that could block the harmful actions of TNF.
Remicade.
Eventually, that antibody became what is today called by its trade name, Remicade. And it was the first member of a whole new class of drugs that work by blocking TNF. And now there are many others that work in a similar way. But Remicade was the very first.
So TNF can cause rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, other illnesses. What determines what it's going to cause? If I have an excess of TNF, why do I get rheumatoid arthritis, and why do you get Crohn's disease?
Again, that has to do with the site of the production of TNF. So if it's overproduced in your joints, you develop arthritis, and if it is overproduced in your gut, you develop Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis.
How long was it before the discovery that TNF could be treated by Remicade and the approval by the FDA?
So the discovery was made in the early 1990s, in 91 or 92. Actually, it was first demonstrated to work in rheumatoid arthritis by Dr. Mark Feldman in London and his colleague Ravinder Maini. And then it took another 7 or 8 years to complete the clinical trials to show conclusively that it is effective and to obtain the approval by the FDA.
In 2013, Remicade was the second highest-selling drug in the world with sales of over $10 billion. Nobody could have anticipated that at the time.
Absolutely. And I didn't anticipate it myself.
Only one out of every 5 to 10,000 compounds studied in preclinical trials will get FDA approval, find its way in the market. Do you keep those statistics in mind when you're working in the lab?
I think if people thought of those statistics, they would get so depressed that they would stop to try to develop some useful medication. So the answer is probably no.
You and your wife use your Remicade royalties to start a foundation. What does your foundation support? The Vilcek Foundation.
So the main mission of the foundation is to raise awareness of the contribution of immigrants in the United States to biomedical science or science in general and the arts. And we have also expanded this mission now to promote the arts and sciences in general.
So you give out awards, and the Vilcek Awards are, they are highly prized. Who are some of your more memorable past winners?
So most people probably know the names of the winners of our prizes in the arts. Scientists who receive the prizes are, of course, very, very accomplished and prominent, but
the
general
the
public
sciences.
Is not so familiar with those names. But just to mention some names that of artists who are well-known, Christo and Jean-Claude were our first winners in the arts, and then Yo-Yo Ma, for example, Mikhail Baryshnikov, and I could go on with some very, very... Mike Nichols was our prize winner, so some very, very well-known people.
And then in February 2013, you were awarded the National Medal of Technology and Innovation. one of the highest achievements in your field. I was thinking, if someone decided to make a movie about your life, it might have to be made as a trilogy because you've had so many different lives.
That's I think, a very appropriate observation.
So,
I sometimes say that I was born under the spell of the Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times.
But you also have to feel very proud of the fact that work that you did is improving the lives of millions of people around the world. You've also donated to NYU School of Medicine, and your donations go to work there as well. But I gather, this interview was organized by the Slovak American Cultural Center, a not-for-profit organization promoting cultural and scientific achievements of Slovak Americans in the United States and abroad. So you're working closely with them as well?
I have gotten to know them relatively recently. I think the organization was formed not so long ago, but I look forward to our cooperation.
Since Czechoslovakia is split up into Czech and Slovak, you think of yourself as Slovak?
I left when the country was still Czechoslovakia.
Love and Science, Jan Vilcek's book, is published by Seven Stories Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
My pleasure.